Mudlarking, written and read by Lara Makelam.
An old woman with a nutcracker nose and chin, which almost dipped into the filthy slush into which she peered, and dirty flesh as well as a scrap or two of dirty linen showing through the slashes of her burst gown, over which, for warmth's sake, she wore a tippet of ragged sackcloth. She slinks off to her lair, followed by an imp bearing a rusty, crumpled colander piled with its find. Its sex is indistinguishable. It has long, mud-hued hair hanging down in a mat over its shoulders. Through the hair, one gets a glimpse of a never-washed little face, whose only sign of intelligence is an occasional glance of wicked knowingness. Richard Rowe, A Pair of Mudlarks, from Life in the London Streets, 1881. Mudlark. Mudlark, noun. A person who scavenges for usable debris in the mud of a river or harbour. Also, a street urchin. Jocular, a messy person, especially a child. To carry the occupation of a mudlark. Also, play in the mud. From the New Oxford English Dictionary on Historical Principles, 1993. It is hot and airless on the 7:42 from Greenwich to Cannon Street. I am squeezed between strangers, straining to avoid the feel of unknown bodies. No one makes eye contact, and no one speaks. There is an unwritten rule of silence on the early morning London commute, and barely a murmur can be heard, just the rustle of newspapers and the high-pitched squeal of the rails as we lurch and sway towards the city. I know every inch of this route. For nearly 20 years it has taken me to the centre of London, for work, to meetings, to see friends, and to visit the river in search of treasure. I know when to hold tight, where the tracks jolt the train to one side, how long the gaps are between stops, and when the driver will start to slow down for the next station. For years I have watched old graffiti fade and new graffiti appear. For 6 months now I have been watching a sports sock, discarded and stuck to the tracks, turned from white to tattered, dirty brown. This journey will take me 17 minutes, and I am impatient. I check my watch again, and work back 3 hours from today's predicted low tide. The river will be at its lowest at 10:23 a.m. My timing is perfect. I twitch and shift from foot to foot as the train pulls out of London Bridge Station, willing it to speed up. I am almost there. We trundle over a railway viaduct, past Southwark Cathedral with its dappled flint dressing and Gothic spires, and through the centre of Borough Market. I look out over its glazed roof and try to spot the cast-iron pineapples balanced above one of the entrances. Then the sky opens up, and I am above the river on Cannon Street Bridge, water flowing towards me from the west and away from me to the east. I scan the river on both sides, peering through the bodies over newspapers and around rucksacks to check the tide. A patch of slime-covered rubble is just beginning to show through. It is close to the river wall, but the tide is falling. By the time I get down there, the river will have dropped even further, and enough of the foreshore will be exposed for me to begin my search. It amazes me how many people don't realise the river in central London is tidal. I hear them comment on it as they pause at the river wall above me while I'm mudlarking below. Even friends who have lived in the city for years are oblivious to the high and low tides that chase each other around the clock, inching forwards every 24 hours, one tide gradually creeping through the day while the other takes the night shift. They have no idea that the height between low and high water at London Bridge varies from 15 to 22 feet. Or that it takes 6 hours for the water to come upriver and 6.5 for it to flow back out to sea. I am obsessed with the incessant rise and fall of the water. For years my spare time has been controlled by the river's ebb and flow, and the consequent covering and uncovering of the foreshore.